Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. Welcome to U.S. National Politics. We apologize for the technical difficulty for the delay in our show this afternoon. Tonight's show is the origin of the American welfare state. I'm your host, Chauncey Brown, and our co-host is Dr. Jerome Hyler. Welcome, Doctor. So today, we are going to talk about the American welfare state and consider how early it was established and how it grew to where it has amassed a public debt that is now in excess of $22 trillion. Is that correct, Professor?
Yes, it is. And I think I should explain further that it is specifically welfare spending, not any other portion of the federal government's budget, that alone counts for that colossal debt. As we shall define welfare here, 75 cents of every dollar Washington spends each year is spent not on national defense or law enforcement and justice, but on the whole gamut of welfare policies that have been authorized over the past two plus centuries.
I suspect most Americans associate welfare or public assistance with all those entitlements that assist the aged, the sick, and the poor. They'd say it all began with the New Deal effort to combat the Great Depression with Social Security and FDR's job programs. It then evolved into the Great Society programs under LBJ, Medicare, Medicaid, food stamps, housing assistance, and the like. If that was the case, we wouldn't be having this conversation, right? So when do you think the American welfare state was born?
Let me ask you this. Why is it welfare when government deprives taxpayers of their earnings to help out the aged, the sick, and the poor, but not when the same Americans are taxed or their liberties restricted to help the well-connected and well-to-do? We are talking about already prosperous corporations, prominent financial interests and firms, and any organization that decides to send an army of lobbyists to Capitol Hill, the White House, or some powerful administrative agency. That never made any sense to me. To find the true origins of the American welfare state, we have to know exactly what we are looking for, what welfare really is. Medicare and all the entitlements, the full range of anti-poverty efforts, certainly they form a large part of the welfare state, but they are not the whole of it. To best understand the essence of welfare or identify the full range of welfare functions governments perform, it will be best to view them against a conception of politics, a set of principles that are unalterably opposed to any form of welfare. It turns out that what welfare isn't is embodied in this country's founding principles.
Professor, why exactly do you say the founding principles forbid Congress from creating welfare programs? How could the founders forbid it? Why would they?
Well, listen to what Jefferson said. All men are created equal and endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. In other words, every person has a right to simply live and let live, to gain, keep, use, trade, or otherwise dispose of his freely acquired possessions, what the founders called the just fruits of honest industry. Unfortunately, and for some time afterwards, African Americans and women were left out, but not anymore. Now, if all men are created equal, when they form government, they have a right to be treated that way. That is, to be equally protected in the enjoyment of their lives, liberties, and possessions. But when Congress confers special benefits or privileges on some, it necessarily denies equal protection under law to all. In other words, the founding principles made government a protector, protecting all in the enjoyment of what was theirs, their lives, liberties, and possessions. It could not become a provider, not without trashing the principle of equality and instead creating winners and losers. No longer can everyone simply live and let live. I say that whenever government provides special advantages to any, whatever the form they may take, what it provides might as well be called welfare.
Professor, but you say the founding principles offered no such authorization to government bodies. Why? What makes you so sure?
Well, listen to Jefferson. He said, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from where? From the consent of the governed. That principle identifies for us in crystal clear terms exactly how limited government was meant to be. If government's power comes exclusively from the consent of the governed, and if no person has a power to take away or give away what doesn't belong to him, no one can consent to give to government such a power. Here's how John Locke put it, America's instructor. Quote, for nobody can transfer to another more power than he has in himself, and nobody has an absolute arbitrary power over any other to take away the life or property of another. And having originally no arbitrary power over the life, liberty, or possessions of another, but only so much as the law of nature gives him to the preservation of himself, this is all he doth or can give up to the commonwealth, so that the legislative can have no more than this. And yet modern politics has become the place not just entitlement enthusiasts, but legions of lobbyists employed by crony capitalists go to get special benefits at their neighbor's expense. Real capitalists accept the risks inherent in a free market. Counterfeit capitalists prefer to appeal to government to help reduce or eliminate those worrisome risks. Never mind that the privileges are enjoyed at others' expense, if just the taxpayers.
Professor, so you're saying that there is social welfare and there is corporate welfare. These are the two sides of the same coin, right?
Yes. They both stack the deck, and they introduce into Republican government the germ of corruption. Elected representatives dispense sundry benefits and are happy to be paid for the privileges they generously dispense to their constituent interests. It's worth adding that this corruption doesn't begin with special interests pleading and lobbying for special favors, but with public servants imagining they have the power to grant them. The essence of welfare is its capacity to benefit some and harm others. It consists then of pork, bacon, earmarks, member items, constituent services, farm subsidies, protective tariffs, business bailout, paid to play, and too big to fail.
Okay, Professor. Then all you have to do now is explain what made the Tariff Act of 1789 an act of welfare. After all, the Constitution itself expressly grants Congress the power to impose tariffs.
Yes, it does. To pay the expenses of government and settle the substantial debt incurred during the struggle for independence, the Revolution. The Tariff Act of 1789, however, allowed tariffs, yes, for the support of government, yes, for the discharge of the debts of the United States, but also for, quote, the encouragement and protection of manufacturers.
Then the question is, what about it makes it a welfare program? Who benefited and at whose expense?
I'm glad you ask. Manufacturers, domestic manufacturers, certainly benefited. Their strong lobbying efforts, pleading for protective tariffs, tells us they well knew they would benefit by the protective tariffs. And they had friends and favorites in the first legislature who granted them those favors. Now, since tariffs are like sales taxes collected on imported items and make those items more expensive. Manufacturers, finding themselves with less foreign competition, were able to raise their prices and enjoy higher profits behind those blessed tariff walls. But what about all the Western farmers and Southern planters who had to sell their crops in a politically unprotected market but pay artificially higher prices for the tools, utensils, weapons, textiles, and so forth they had to purchase? Those in these lines of work were aggrieved parties, and they knew it. The farmers knew it. The planters knew it. And it's worse. Since European firms were unable to sell their finished goods in America, they lacked the foreign exchange, that is the money, to purchase the abundant fruit of America's soil. Planters and farmers lost their own foreign markets once those states imposed retaliatory tariffs, as is customary. And that's not all. The falling off of once brisk transatlantic trade left American shipbuilders, seaport merchants, and thousands employed in the maritime trades high and dry. The carrying trades, the thousands who normally transported the goods from the wharfs to the interior parts of the country, lost their livelihoods as well. All compliments of Congress. There's much more that could be said about the corporate welfare policies pursued during President Washington's tenure from 1789 to 1797. There's no time to go over that ground here. We will in subsequent shows.
Doctor, before we continue, I just want to give, we have some listeners on the line. I want to let them know that this is U.S. National Politics Blog Talk Radio Show. I'm your host, Sean T. Brown, the co-host, Dr. Jerome Hyler, and today's show is The Origins of the American Welfare State. We want to thank all of our listeners. As we continue, Professor, then how are you going to explain how we got from that day to this? You said you would answer that question in today's show.
Believe it or not, it's not difficult to answer the question how we got from that day, that early day, with the first protective tariff, that, by the way, was signed on July 4th, 1789, a propitious date, to answer the question how we got from that early time to this time with such a staggeringly large welfare state. So here's my principle. I'm going to state it twice because it's a little much to take in. Quote, this is my own quote. Once a nation decides that some of its citizens have a right not to go out and get, but to lobby Congress and be given, that nation must face two inevitable questions. Who else should be given? And how much should everyone get? What's the answer? There's only one answer. Politics. Let me repeat that. Once a nation decides that some of its citizens, in this first case, domestic manufacturers, have a right not just to go out and get, but to lobby Congress and be given, that nation faces two inevitable questions. Who else should be given, and how much should everyone get? And as I said, there's only one answer, politics. And that's how corruption spreads. That is how spending grows and grows and grows. There's a historical quote, we're not too sure of its authorship, but it sums up things quite neatly and should serve as a warning to all. It says, "A democracy cannot exist as a permanent form of government. It can only exist until the voters discover that they can vote themselves money from the public treasury. From that moment on, the majority always votes for the candidates promising the most benefits from the public treasury, with the result that a democracy always collapses over loose fiscal policy, always followed by dictatorship. The average age of the world's greatest civilizations has been 200 years. and we, by the way, have exceeded our limit. These nations, almost all nations, all democratic nations, have progressed through a single sequence. The lessons of history give ample evidence of the validity of this sequence. From bondage to spiritual faith. From spiritual faith to great courage. From courage to liberty. From liberty to abundance. From abundance to complacency. From complacency to apathy. From apathy to dependency. From dependency back into bondage.
Professor, you have given our listeners a lot to digest. We do have several extra minutes. Would you like to expound a little bit more on this topic today?
Yes, because there is an upshot, a bottom line that has been hidden to current generations, hidden to past generations, that is worth considering. There's a lot more to say. So let me just put this question to our listeners. What if the long succession of panics and the succeeding periods of deep and prolonged hardship that cried out for social welfare reform in the Progressive and New Deal periods were caused not by laissez-faire capitalism, not by free market activities, but those periods of hardship were really caused by the corporate welfare policies increasingly corrupt governments blissfully undertook? In other words, what I'm suggesting is that the corporate welfare state created bubbles, artificial bubbles of prosperity, which ultimately burst, causing hardship, and there leading to the admission of corporate welfare policies. So we needed the corporate welfare state in order to remedy the many problems that were created. We needed the social welfare state to act as a remedy for all of the economic and social problems that were first created by the corporate welfare state. Corporate welfare state policies led by increasingly corrupt governments that did the bidding of lobbyists and corporations actually created the problems for which the social welfare state appeared as the solution. I am going to talk a lot more about this in subsequent conversations.
I just want to share with you, this is a good analogy of two wrongs don't make a right.
Yes, and if it wasn't for the first wrong, the rise of the corporate welfare state, there would have been no need for the second wrong, the subsequent social welfare state, the massive sums of taxes that relieve everyone of the honest earnings of their industry, the honest fruits of their just labors. And there we go.
So what you're saying is that one must feed on the other in order to exist. They cannot coexist independently of themselves. So in other words, for our country, we really need to consider getting rid of the welfare system, because it has led not only to corruption, it has led to oppressing groups of people. It has led to, like you had stated earlier, taking money from those who and redistributing wealth. So people that earn the money doesn't necessarily have to give it to someone else. Based on
and
politics.
That is what the welfare state makes possible. I'd like to put it this way. I've written it like this. There is nothing wrong with this country that a nationwide grassroots welfare revolt, an armed uprising, peaceful, accomplished at the voting booth, but sustained and looking to cut government programs, or another way I say it is that it's 2020 very shortly. The people of this country should get together, show the establishment polls the door of both parties, the establishment politicians of both parties engaged in all of this welfare giveaways, corporate and social, show politicians of both parties the door, and I like to say, send an army of Mr. Smith after the great James Stewart movie, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. Send an army of Mr. Smith to Washington under firm instruction to cut programs, close agencies, and shrink the size and expense of government. No problem needs any more remedial action than such a movement in this country.
And the ironic part is that as a result of the Tariff Act and as a result of corporate welfare and now social welfare, I'm trying to remember what my point was, how I'm throwing down to my point of
This is heady stuff. If we can
It is because now you can't get rid of one without the other. They both have to coexist. Oh, the point that I wanted to make briefly is as a result of the federal government taking these steps, that's how we ended up with local corruption, because now the states do the same thing. And they keep passing the buck. And then localities do the same thing, and they keep passing the buck.
The only thing I would correct you in here, Chauncey, is that it is not that because the federal government became engaged in corporate welfare and later social welfare that the states and localities became involved, taking a leaf from the federal government. In fact, even before the Constitution went into force, there was this kind of corruption in the states themselves. Even more so, as developed by one of the greatest historians of the Revolutionary period, a man by the name of Bernard Bailyn, he shows in a little book called The Origins of American Politics how before the American Revolution, there were all kinds of families and factions and parties in each of the 13 colonies that were engaged in lobbying the local legislatures or the state legislatures for special benefits, basically for corporate welfare. So it began a long time ago. As a matter of fact, it's as old as human history itself.
I know we don't have much time. I just want to mention Europeans left Europe for taxation without representation, but they've adopted that same policy here with the tariff.
Well, the problem is that the tariff was duly passed by a duly functioning Congress.
You
can't say that we weren't represented. You can say that we tossed the Constitution out the window to create this species of special privilege, the protective tariff.
Dr. Heiler, I want to thank you very much for coming on to the show. I want to thank our listeners for listening in. You can also listen to the show or revisit our prior shows at U.S. National Politics Blog Talk Radio. And this show will be available within a half hour if you want to re-listen to this show. Also, please stay tuned on next Tuesday at 4 o'clock, our next show, The Goodness That Greatness Begot. Please join Dr. Heiler and myself as we get into that a little bit more next week about the progressive left. Dr. Heiler, I know we're out of time. I want to say thank you again. Would you like to say anything real quick in closing?
Yes, I just want to say that to all of those progressive left-wingers who criticize and condemn America for being a land filled with racism, sexism, homophobia, xenophobia, white privilege, toxic masculinity, and rampant police brutality, the talk next week will be to revive the American character and let Americans know that Americans, the most prosperous, the freest, most prosperous people, are also the most generous and caring people to ever people the planet. It is just another liberal lie to accuse this country of all the things they accuse this country of.
Thank you very much, Dr. Heiler, and thank all our listeners. Please follow us at National Politics on Facebook and at Blog Talk Radio, U.S. National Politics. Thank you again for listening, and we'll see you next Tuesday at 4 o'clock. Have a good evening, and God bless America.